Peter R. Bregan, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
Hello. Hello, my wonderful audience. You have no idea how much this once-a-week radio TV show means to me. And I'm smiling because I had planned to do a show with a friend of mine, but the lines didn't work, the communication lines. And so I'm going to give you a surprise show, and it's going to be really good. Very recently, I did a show on epidemic anxiety, and I talked about everything from the coronavirus to panic attacks and clinical, so-called clinical anxiety, all of which mostly is totally misrepresented by psychology and psychiatry alike. Well, there are three primary basic negative emotions. And as I mentioned, I talked about anxiety last time. Another one is shame, and then finally is guilt. Now, today I'm going to talk about shame, epidemic shame. And it's epidemic in our political arena, and it's epidemic in humanity. It's always been with us. It is the main emotion of social control. So before you just switch off and say, well, I don't feel shame, because a lot of people think, shame? What does he mean? Humiliation? No. Feeling like running away and hiding when somebody teases me? That's not me. I don't have shame. I can speak in public. I can do just about anything. It's not possible to not have shame. Not at all possible. Can't be done. Every single culture known to humanity on every level of supposed civilization has shame in it, and every human being can experience shame. Shame is so deeply built within us that there are signals we give when we feel ashamed. Unless we've learned to control them, we turn red. That's like a signal. Okay, you shamed me, you got me. That's how deep shame is in the human biology. And in addition, many people have common symptoms of the way they hold themselves. These are not as involuntary. These can be controlled better than the blush, which, by the way, for some people is a total body affair. But people tend to slouch. They tend to slink in the cartoons when they feel ashamed. They avert their eyes. Shame affects us very, very deeply. And shame can afflict us in the way we usually think of it as, you know, being quiet and shy and embarrassed and having trouble in public and things like that. But shame actually drives a great deal of blustering. I think that most politicians are compensating for shame. Because when we're loud, when we seem unaffected by what anybody says to us, we are in fact compensating for shame. It's just an overreaction to shame. We won't be felt, but like we won't feel it at all. So we will be the proud lawyer, the proud teacher, or whatever. In fact, pride, which they say goeth before a fall, pride is often just shame-based. When we feel like our pride has been hurt, or we don't want anybody hurting our pride, disrespecting us, that's shame too. Otherwise, we would be able to sit back and say, look at what that person's doing. They think they're insulting me or belittling me. Well, I'm not going to put up with that. I'll absent myself if possible, or, you know, takes measures to ask them to stop and so on. We'll talk more about that later. So shame just comes in these tremendous kinds of varieties. When we're angry and at our wives or husbands or our children, it's almost always that we feel ashamed. Our kid won't listen. our wife, our husband won't listen. They don't understand. A feeling of not being understood. Our very identity sense has a lot to do with shame. And in fact, years ago, some of the, at the time, good psychologists, great psychologists, in the existential era of psychiatry, when psychologists actually thought about things a fair amount, not psychiatrists, not so much psychiatrists, but there were existential psychiatrists when I was a younger man. There actually were people in the field of psychiatry who were thoughtful, not like today. By the way, as an aside, I have put up the strongest blog perhaps I've ever written. Don't interrupt the show to go to it, please, but it's on MIA. It's on Madness, Madden America. So go to www.maddenamerica and look up my blog. And I think the title is something like, What's the Most Dangerous Thing You Could Do? And then what I talk about in the blog is that how going to a psychiatrist is the most dangerous thing you can do. I expect some shaming for that, if people are willing to even acknowledge that it exists. And a number of people have said it may be the strongest thing I've written. So put that in the back of your head, because this is going to be one of the strongest blogs I've ever given. So shame just infiltrates and affects us in ways that we just don't have any idea about. Very, very often what we think is just wanting to be respected or wanting to be taken seriously or wanting to have an impact or wanting to make a difference. I mean, that can be healthy in a lot of ways, but often it's driven compulsively by a feeling that we're nobody, we're nothing. And it just can be overwhelming. I'll tell you a story on myself. When I was in college, I was running the Harvard Radcliffe Mental Hospital volunteer program, young man then, maybe at the time of the story, maybe I'm 18 or 19. And at the time, for a time I was a co-director, and at this particular moment in time I was the single director of the program. And I arranged for a dinner for 200 of our volunteers and anybody else who wanted to come and learn about our program. It was a very prestigious building and association at Harvard called the Phillips Brooks House. And I was getting ready to give the main address and walking across Harvard Yard, where Phillips Brooks House is in one corner. And as I got halfway across the yard, I thought, oh my God, I forgot to tell Tony, the chef, that we were having a dinner tonight. And I felt overwhelmed momentarily with humiliation. Like, what do I do when I walk into a room of 200 people at tables and there's no food? I don't even think I had the strength to run and get there and see if there was an alternative solution. And when I got there, everything was fine. Tony, the chef, who was also a wonderful guy, was a handyman and an ex-professional boxer. And he was there cooking away. The meals were going to be served on time. And I had the biggest relief from potential shame and humiliation that I could ever imagine. Now, usually I'm a guilt guy. You know, I feel bad. I'm being a bad person and so on. And that'll be the third show in the triad of guilt, shame, and anxiety. And then I'm going to do a show on chronic anger, and I'm going to do a show on numbing. And all this is drawn from my book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. You can get it. We get it from us, Bregan.com, or you can get it easily, quickly from Amazon. So this can be an interesting show, folks, because when I realized that I was not getting connected, I just strung out a bunch of notes to give this hour talk. But those are my best talks when I'm spontaneous. Those are the best talks you'll see me doing to an audience where I'm just relaxed and I'm talking to hundreds of people spontaneously, and that's what I'm doing to you today, to thousands of people. Isn't that wonderful? God, I love doing this. I so appreciate your being there. It means a lot to me. So again, I'm looking at shame and all the different ways it can affect and how overwhelming it can be to a person. If you're an adult and you have a young daughter and she's hiding in her bedroom and maybe she looks like she's hallucinating, the odds are overwhelming that she is experiencing shame. almost everything that we call psychosis is driven by shame. In fact, what we think of as mania, where somebody is being, quote, grandiose or omnipotent or all-powerful, and their minds are racing a mile a minute, got enormous energy and strength and can do anything, their judgment's not good, their judgment's impaired. Underneath that, I mean, what would make a person go to such an extreme? I mean, think about it. What could be underneath that? Underneath it are feelings of shame, feelings of worthlessness. Feelings we don't matter, and we can't stand being so small in this world we might disappear into oblivion. And instead, we become almighty and powerful, and we are into a manic episode. And no, it's not biochemical. Biochemicals can drive a manic episode. Most of the episodes we see nowadays are actually caused by the stimulants, or even more often, the newer antidepressants, which can be very stimulating. They can flip people over the edge. And I'm not even sure you have to have a manic tendency of any kind to be driven into mania by these drugs, these neurotoxins. All are neurotoxic psychiatric drugs. But the person in mania never thinks they're being driven by shame. They think they're really grand and great. So shame is everywhere. There have been studies in the past of shame cultures. Japan, at least decades ago, which anthropologists were writing about and sociologists, was thought to be a culture that was very much shame-oriented. Their suicides, when they had suicides, were thought to be not from guilt, as often occurs in our culture, but from shame. Feeling humiliated. Just think of me standing in the middle of Harvard Yard, feeling 6 inches tall, thinking I'm going to have to go into a room of 200 people who are waiting for dinner, and I hadn't told Tony. I probably did tell Tony. It wasn't a panic attack. It was a which is anxiety. It was a shame attack, and maybe some anxiety and guilt thrown in. We all have the ability to feel guilt, shame, or anxiety. Shame is a particular issue in our culture for women because young girls are unmercifully shamed by boys. It's a way that those of us with weaker egos when we're young get some power. We make fun of, we tease, we ridicule girls. And they can't fight back, at least in my day they couldn't. Nowadays they're more apt to. Like one of my daughters is a karate expert. It's just a heavy burden for women. And of course, what happens to women in the political limelight, I think it's happening less and less, but again, they will more likely to get belittled than a man. And so shame is a powerful control mechanism. The bullying of boys is sometimes physical threat, which leads to huge anxiety, of course. But the boys will also be shamed and made fun of, their appearance, their having some sort of a different sexual orientation or having an accent. I mean, almost anything can bring ridicule and shame on you. And if you read books by African Americans about what their childhoods would like, they're often going to have in it how they were made fun of. I won't use the words that they were called. So it's a powerful, and of course it happens to Jews like myself. Fortunately, I grew up in the community where that wasn't too common. So the shame is just, I want to really make sure you get it. The shame is there. It's there for all of us. And in fact, the next time you feel irritable, just irritable, that you want to get irritable with your husband or your wife or your kids, think about whether underneath you're feeling in some level a bit of shame, maybe even a bit of more extreme shame, which is humiliation, or you're feeling just misunderstood or not taken seriously. All of this has to do with shame. Now, in reality, all those things could be going on, but what I want you to learn about today and what my book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety is about is you identify these things. When you identify them, you don't allow them to guide your reactions. You don't allow them to tell you who you are. You don't allow them to make your identity or destroy your identity. You recognize them for what they are, and you then take whatever actions at the time are necessary. I often find, at least now that I'm an older gentleman, if I just simply say to somebody, hey, what's going on? You don't sound like you're being real friendly here. Or if I'm at a conference, you know, I might just say, well, excuse me for now. Or if I'm at a table and somebody is, you know, getting ready to do some sort of trip on me, they've been waiting 10 years to tell me something and it doesn't look pleasant, I'll just say, you're giving me a stomach ache. Please. But there also come times when that won't work. And I do think that there come a time when young people have to fight, even physically. That's going to be pretty that's going to be pretty controversial in today's day and age. But I think that there comes a time when people sometimes have to make an ultimate statement. You're not going to, you know, you're not going to grab me by the lapels and put your face in my face. And, you know, that's something that we have a lot of discussion about. But by and large, most confrontations about shame can be avoided. And you want to avoid them because if we look at road rage, for example, I mean, you could get involved in a road rage with somebody and you finally decide you're not going to take it. You know, maybe they've pulled you off at the highway and you know, they're banging on your car window. Well, don't open your window. You know, try to drive off, because that road rage has nothing to do with you. It has to do with the profound shame reactions. Pretty much all rage is a shame. So this poor soul was driving along, and he thinks or she thinks you've cut them off, or that you didn't obey the traffic light, or that somehow or other you weren't taken seriously as a driver. It makes no rational sense because they don't know you. Why should they freak out over you? Why should they risk going to jail over you? Why should they want to hurt a stranger like you? Maybe you had a bad day. Maybe you didn't see him. Or maybe you do cut off people. Why should anybody have road rage? It's not good for anybody. But it's driven by shame. God, do you see? Are you getting a picture of just how invasive and destructive these reactions can be? Now, one of the problems is that shame is sometimes actually seen as attractive, especially if a little girl is shy. Ah, isn't she adorable? Isn't she cute? I think we have to be very, very careful about this as parents, as people who are dealing with children. Try not to see shyness as something adorable. It's a sign that the person's been hurt by other human beings. It's a sign that the person's been made to feel small or potentially insignificant or potentially the butt of being shamed, So keep that in mind and do your best not to tease people, not to shame people, not to make fun of people, and not to accept it. There may be situations where you know somebody well and you can kid back and forth and you get some pleasure out of it and they get some pleasure out of it. But be very careful because often it's a dominance thing. It's a dominance thing. And men, be very careful of it with your wives and your children, but women too. But I think that women are more exposed in our society to humiliation. It's a part of patriarchy, which is still with us. It's a part of men feeling they need women so bad that they have to act superior to them. You know, a lot of it, maybe women will be interested in this, or maybe you figured it out, but a lot of the belittling that men do of women is because they feel they need them so much and they don't know how to relate to them. In my practice, for example, if I see a husband threatening, maybe a little twitch of a hand in a very early couples therapy, usually the first session, I pick this up, or I see the wife putting down her head or whatever, I just say, you know, I think there's some bullying going on in this family. I think there's humiliation. And Joe, what do you think, Joe? Are you doing that? And he might just be so caught off guard, and I'm so pleasant about it, he might say, well, what else am I going to do? I said, well, tell me about what you mean by what else are you going to do? I mean, if she were armed, would you be doing these things? She had a gun and you didn't. I mean, listen, I'm going to give you the good news and then the good news. The first good news is you're going to stop this. You're going to learn with me and your wife that you can't even threaten to hit. You can't even hint at hitting, and you can't shame, and you can't put down your wife. And then you're going to learn, it's all going to start today. We've only been in the session 30 minutes. You're going to start learning today that the way to get more from your loved one than you ever imagined is to love them more than you've ever imagined, to treat them with respect first. That allows for love, and then with love. And with reason and ethics. I mean, that's the whole of life, as some of you have heard from me again and again. And again, it's the basis of my book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, and also my scientific papers on the subject, which you can also find on my website, but the book's the source. So I'm in right away to some of the ways that we handle this kind of thing. We have to replace shame reactions where we feel we can't get what we need, or we feel we're being put down, or our wife's getting away with something, or our kids are getting away, or our husband's getting away. We have to replace it with talking about it, explaining what's going on, and deciding that we will get what we want from others by being very loving and very vulnerable with the people near to us. And this works in many circumstances. I can only think of one place this hasn't worked with a lawyer. And that is, lawyers like to put people down. They learn that, I don't know, that we're in a shame society more and more. Judges allow on cross-examination and criminal trials and malpractice trials, which I'm in, and product liability trials. They allow lawyers to shame expert witnesses to try to make them look stupid. And by the way, I think it was also on my other show, one on anxiety, there's a little woodpecker that comes and goes pop, 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 pop beside my window just out of my sight. So there's a little downy going pop, 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 pop in the background. Caught me off guard last time. But I now gather what's happening. You may or may not hear it. It did show up on the my initial series, which was about epidemic anxiety, and we're talking about epidemic shame right now. I was going to say that I've had lawyers who are just notorious for shaming people. They walk in and insult you at the start of a deposition on tape, on or video, possibly. And I've learned that if I, at least, and this goes, I'm older, but when you're younger, you'll find your own ways. You know, if I just say, hey, guys, I'm not going to sit here and have you be shaming me or bullying me, nor am I going to do it back. I'm going to end the depo temporarily if this continues. And I rarely have to even get that far because I'm warm, I'm friendly, I'm vulnerable. And at the first moment, I sense in my vulnerability. So your vulnerability makes you more aware of when you're going to be attacked by anger or shaming or guilting or anxiety provocations. So being vulnerable, I'm open, I'm welcoming, and that makes me so alert to what's going on because I'll start real quick to feel uncomfortable. The minute I do, I ask the person to stop what they're doing. I just friendly say, stop what you're doing. And that's what happens in a good friendship, a good marriage, good parenting. When you're vulnerable with people around you, but you know that you won't be, you just won't accept being made uncomfortable by people. You just won't accept it. People have to find a way of relating to you and you to them so everybody's comfortable. And if you just are, let yourself be vulnerable. Don't be the shame person who's, big and strong and tough. And don't be the shame person who's shy and withdrawn. And certainly don't be manic. That's a disaster. Be the person who says, all right, I know I'm vulnerable to shame or to guilt or to anxiety, and I'm going to be open and aware of that. And in my relationships, when I sense it, I'm going to suggest that it stop. And if it's not with a loved one, I'm going to say I'm going to absent myself. You don't want to absent yourself from a loved one unless you just really feel at the edge, on the edge, because that shames them. You're ostracizing them by leaving them. So anyhow, be really careful about all these things I'm talking about. Learn about them. Learn what shame reactions are. And sometimes it'll be anxiety. A lot of people have a fear of going on the stage, singing and things like that. And some of that's an anxiety, like you're just going to pass out on the stage, but from a beating heart and so on and so forth. And some of it's shame, that you'll make a fool of yourself and be stupid. Shame is the great enemy of creativity. Learn to identify and say, I'm going to do this. I'm not going there. I'm going to replace you with taking a loving attitude toward what I'm doing. I'm going to enjoy being an artist, and I'm going to do it when I feel shame about it. No, I better not. I better tear this up, throw it away. Say, no, I'm not going there. If you're going to stand in front of an audience and you're feeling it, you're going to be a fool, go down and meet the folks. Be kind and loving to the folks and ask them what they'd like you to talk about. Make a relationship. Go back up on the stage. Relate to the folks around you. The antidote to just about every misery is to relate in a caring fashion. If you can make it to a loving level, do that. But otherwise, do it in a caring, thoughtful fashion. Be there for the person. Relate to them. Engage them best you can. That's the main and best antidote. I want to talk about boys now, because something is going on in our culture which is very different than ever happened before. My friend Jeannie Stolza is a professor, and she'll be on the show soon. She really helped me understand this even deeper. I was in Kearney, Nebraska, giving a talk there at the University of Nebraska, invited by Jeannie. That's how I met her. And I looked around the cafeteria and said, where are all the boys? Where are all the young men? They weren't there, or very few. And Jeannie told me something I didn't know. If I knew, I didn't take it seriously enough. And that is that the proportions of male to female have reversed in every kind of schooling, whether it's med school, law school, undergraduate school, in most but not all departments. And Jeannie and I talked about, and she's written about this in scientific articles, that we're raising a generation of boys who feel embarrassed about being men. They feel guilty and they feel embarrassed about having, quote, the superior role. That's all shame language. Superior, better. It's shaming. Well, you're not so superior. You're a white man and you're a boy. You're a white boy. You know, that's the object now of so much political shaming. I think teachers are doing this reverse of what it used to be. I'm really, really glad that women are being so much more respected, even at an early age in the classrooms, and feeling so much more empowered and going on to graduate schools, really making more out of their lives in the ways they want. This is marvelous. This is absolutely marvelous. But it's overshot, and we're taking boys apart. I see it even in many of the young men at Cornell and at Ithaca College, and just people I meet when I've, meet people. Young men are shyer, they're less confident, they think manliness is bad. Manliness is not bad. Men are built in part to defend women. That's who we are. We have this larger size, going to say superior, which would have been a kind of a shame thing. This larger, more muscular frame, by and large, not always. There are women who are bigger and stronger than men. But men were built to hunt and to protect. And women were built initially to nurture. Well, they were built to nurture, be soft, be able to nurse. There are these differences built in. We just have to profoundly respect them, and we have to allow men and women to be who they want to be. If a man wants to stay home and take care of the babies and the children, bless him. And if a woman wants to be a less engaged mother and go out and make a mark on the world, earn a living, that's fine, bless her. But we need to look at the costs and the problems involved with it, but We'll talk more with Jeannie Stolzer about that when she comes on. But again, shame issues. Boys are being shamed. They're being shamed so much on colleges that they're giving rooms, men and women. There should be men and women, not boys and girls in college, young men and women. And now, you know, they've got all these vulnerabilities and sensitivities, and, you know, they can get sparked, what is the word, triggered, and they've got rooms when they feel like withdrawing to go to. That is not a good idea. Do not ever cater to shame. Be proud. Stand up for yourself. Don't feel you have to go into a room. Goodness gracious. Our campuses are not dangerous to quiet, shy people. They're frankly dangerous to more conservative people like me. I mean, we get stoned. But they're not dangerous in general to the students unless they come up with a view that threatens the progressives. So, you know, you don't have to have too much fear on a campus. You certainly don't have to go and hide in a room. It's not good for you to hide in a room. Not good for you to have a secret place to go to at work, at school. Not secret, of course, but a place to go to where you can hide, withdraw, recover your senses. Be proud. Be strong. I remember as a young man reading a book, maybe it was even a poem, about a Native American who walked straight and tall across the plains and across the hills. And I thought, that's not enough for me. I'm going to be that. Be that. Be that. Man or woman. Child, girl, boy, be that. Be tall, straight. Even if you're short like me, be tall, be straight, be proud in a way that isn't shame-driven, but respect yourself. Respect yourself. Now, I want to go back a little bit and talk about evolution, and I won't do too much of that. A lot of people aren't interested in it, and some people don't believe it. But I believe that shame evolved as an evolutionary way of controlling our groups. Now, originally, our groups were limited really to extended family. And for hundreds of thousands of years, and even millions, if we go back probably to primates, they were little men and women climbing out of trees on 2 feet, running around and running back up the trees when we got scared, that people shamed each other to get each other to conform to the needs of the group. And that, if you think about everything we've talked about, you can see where shame fits in to helping people conform or forcing people to conform to the norms of the group. Now, the problem with it is it wreaks havoc on individuality and creativity. And the other problem is that if it's excessive, it becomes dangerous to the individual in the group because people get violent when they're shamed too much. So these are these imperfect mechanisms built in by the sometimes quite haphazard events of evolution, where adaptations occur or don't occur depending on whether or not the gene changed, whether or not the circumstances could allow for the adaptation and so on, or welcome the adaptation. But in this process, we develop guilt, shame, and anxiety, which I think were primarily control mechanisms. But shame, the big social control mechanism, comes straight out of evolution, and that's why it's tied so much to our showing physical signs, including blushing. It is the only clearly physically signaled emotion. Anxiety, you can feel, you pound, you sweat, you tremor, but it isn't, it's more an internal signal about fight or flight. Shame is the signal, you got me, I'm ashamed. So keep that in mind. You don't need that anymore. We may have needed it up until a couple of thousand years ago, but since then, we've had books and religions and philosophies that have taught us that love for each other is the key, and that we can learn to love one another, which we always did do, because that was the ultimate cohesion. The ultimate cohesion wasn't guilt, shame, and anxiety. The ultimate cohesion was what we call, the ultimate Cohesion was love in connection with the infant. Attachment psychology shouldn't be called attachment psychology, it's reality. The ultimate cohesion for human beings is the nurturing relationship originally between child and a mother who nursed for several years on demand. That's what went on until we developed villages and we started farming and we started having lots of leisure time for other things. It was all about the mother. And it doesn't so much take a village, as I've said before, to raise a child. It takes a mother, a nursing mother, to raise a child. The village didn't exist until 10,000 years ago. Well, what the mother needed was the family, the extended family, to support her while she nursed and cared for the child, and then would take the child with her, with the other women, maybe with some men, I hope so, to go out and do the gathering under sometimes difficult and dangerous circumstances. It's that bond, it's the loving bond that we human beings have that is so deep and profound. You know, I'm going to be 84 in May. I am still learning more about the loving bond. It is so deep in us. It's the most beautiful thing we have. It's the strongest thing we have. Very, very, very important. The loving bond. So guilt, shame, and anxiety, we don't need it anymore because we've grown enough. We have enough psychology and understanding to know this. Now, the loving bond gets damaged by guilt, shame, and anxiety in childhood. It gets damaged by sex abuse, which is extraordinarily common, by emotional abuse, which seems to happen everywhere. No matter how good a parent you are, things go wrong. You go haywire, you're exhausted, your child's sick, then your child's annoying. It's really hard for us human beings. What we must come back to is the loving bond. That is the answer to guilt, shame, and anxiety, and chronic anger and numbing. The loving bond. And we do it by reason. We couldn't do it before. We don't need guilt, shame, and anxiety. I've had Christians say to me, you know, don't we need guilt? Don't we need shame? Don't we? No. In fact, if you're a Christian, which I'm not, I've benefited a lot from understanding Christianity, learned a lot from the sayings of Jesus and the life of Jesus, but I'm Jewish. And what I see is that Jesus, in fact, died in the Christian theology to make you free, make us free, not just of guilt, but of our sins, guilt, shame, and anxiety, of all the torments. I mean, if Christianity makes any sense at all, it's not just that he died for our guilt, for our sins, but our sins have made us ashamed, too, and anxious, too. So we don't need guilt, shame, and anxiety. Christianity and other religions tell us we don't need it. Judaism tells us with less force, less clarity. We don't need it. It doesn't have to be there. You don't need guilt, shame, and anxiety. We don't need it anymore. We can learn in a multiple different ways to be kind and loving and caring, to find love in our hearts. I'm talking now about with your people you're close to, but also when I'm speaking, when anyone is speaking. When politicians are addressing the country, they should be thinking this way. Loving the country, loving the people in the country. Whatever you're doing. If you're a lawyer, you're going to do better if you're helping people in a loving manner because you'll be making them stronger, more able to listen to you, more able to reason. Same with doctors, same with anybody. And as for psychotherapy without a caring, loving, reasonable relationship is going to make the person feel worse than ever. Even if they say they're being helped, people will say a lot of things and think a lot of things. But if you don't come away with more of a sense of how to love and be loved from a therapy, you're missing out on the single most important healing process, which is loving and being loved. And that includes shame as well. So you learn to identify shame, You then learn to say to it, your primitive emotion. I've amended several names to place on these things. You're a primitive emotion. You're a Stone Age emotion. You're what I call in my books, my articles, a negative legacy emotion. And how are you a negative legacy emotion? You're a legacy emotion from evolution. You're a legacy emotion from childhood. So we enter childhood with the capacity to feel these, all these negative emotions and shame very, very powerfully. And we then have it aggravated or ameliorated by the circumstances. Abuse will breed it, neglect, abandonment. Hard to go back and see who's been neglected, who's been abandoned, when. If it's early enough, you'll never remember it. But it just builds terrible shame and then anger. So first, we inherit it genetically, biologically. I think of their instincts. I think we should call guilt, shame, and anxiety, and anger, and numbingness. You can even see animals go numb when they're in terrible circumstances. I think these are instincts. So we have them as instinctual capacities, which are then transformed, shifted. And so people grow up, some with a lot of shame, some with a lot of guilt, some with a lot of anxiety. Certainly as a young person, I had all of them. But some people have really one or the other, much more proportionally, and they're ruled by it. Don't be ruled by these things. Identify them and say, no more. I know who you are. I'm going to shift my attention and my mind and my heart to a reasonable approach and a loving approach to whatever it is I'm doing, whether it's with another person or not. When I first had the opportunity to sit calmly by a lake, I'd done a fair amount of being, I was very much alone as a child. We lived near Atlantic beaches. I would go off as a little toddler practically for hours and wander in sand dunes and sit by the water and meet fishermen. One time I met soldiers practicing for the invasion of D-Day. They didn't know they were practicing for that, but they were coming in their big boats and dropping the fronts and charging the beaches. They gave me K rations. That's me as a child. So being so alone and all, I would have to have a certain shyness about me and a certain shame about me. But once I got into that and I just forgot my line, and since you're not a live audience, you're a live audience. What a dumb thing to say, because you can't yell back at me and tell me what I was just talking about. But I'll probably wind around to it. So you don't need it anymore. You can be loving. You can be rational. You can be reasonable. Don't let these things do you in. Don't accept them. Don't argue, I had to feel ashamed. I was ashamed. There was no way out. It's inevitable. No. I'll even grant it's an instinct and tell you it's not inevitable. The capacity for violence is an instinct. Extreme violence. The men among us, maybe there were some women too. We used to kill mammoths 500,000 years ago with pointed sticks. Oh, hey, we have the ability for violence, but that doesn't mean we ever have to use it. We may, under certain circumstances, need to use it, but it's pretty rare as an adult male in America. Unless you're a professional fighter, football player, or something like that, you're not going to much need to be able to bring up violence. And even then, if you notice ball games, the guys try to get in each other's heads, they're trying to make each other shamed and violent. You see that in boxing matches, they whisper in. Mike Tyson used to whisper in the ears, and then finally he bit an ear of an opponent. It's coming out of shame to do the kind of ridiculous thing, feeling he had to dominate, lose control of himself. So even if you were an athlete, you don't want to get violent. You want to be under control. And that's why players try to get in each other's heads, why they try to, say things that make them lose their tempers, get thrown out of the game. You ask yourself, how does some really fine college player end up taking a swing at somebody in the middle of a championship ball game? Shame. We don't need shame. We don't need to let other people do it to us. I want to take a second. I haven't looked at my notes the whole time. and see what other issues I might want in particular talk about. One of the more important issues, if you are many people who listen to me are mental health workers, one kind or another, or in therapy. Shame is not likely to come up in professional therapy very much. And there are powerful reasons for that. Shame, we don't want to think about shame. We don't want to imagine shame. We don't want to share shame feelings. Wasn't any fun for me to tell you about being a college kid practically sinking into Harvard Yard in shame. We don't want to admit that when our early girlfriends rejected us, we felt humiliated, we felt worthless. We want to think we felt angry. So therapists and clients often don't want to talk about shame. Husbands and wives often don't want to talk about shame. They want to talk about being anxious, being angry, maybe even feeling guilty, maybe even feeling anxious. But shame is probably a more important control factor in your life. Certainly when I became what appeared to be a threat to psychiatry, and I was giving speeches about it and going on TV about it, certainly the biggest threat to me was shame. Name-calling, belittling, even in written down sometimes. Maybe a TV interviewer. It was certainly was shame. Now, a lot of people wouldn't have even thought about that being a shame, you know. They were just trying to, control me or something. But think about shame and think about how you can identify it. Don't be ashamed of having shame. In fact, people have anticipatory shame. If they see a situation, a room full of people they don't want to go into, a situation they don't want to go into, a question they don't want to answer that they think is coming up, a look on our wife's or husband's face that we think we're going to get teased or something. We get anticipatory shame and we shut down. And we move usually toward numbness or anger or irritability. So learn about shame. Accept that you have shame. There's just no way you don't. Remember, there are whole cultures that are dominated by nothing but shame. And we're becoming more and more of a shame culture politically. Our boys are being shamed the way girls used to be. There's just no place for it anywhere. No racial or religious shaming. No place for it. But it's there. And it's always there between people. It's there. Don't put up with it. But first, you got to admit it. You got to admit it. Anytime somebody makes a joke on you, it's shaming. Teases you, it's shaming. Smirks at you, it's shaming. When I work with couples and families, if I see somebody smirk or sneer or condescending voice, I very gently ask the recipient how that made them feel. Then they're not going to say ashamed. They'll say, I don't like it. They'll say that. I don't like it. Or it made me mad. But if you want to be vulnerable, admit that we're all potentially a basket of guilt, shame, anxiety, chronic anger, and numbing. We all are. And if you're a therapist and you're dealing with somebody who's alienated from reality into an alternative reality, or if you're a parent or a friend or husband or wife, remember that this person you love is probably feeling worthless. That's shame. Bad is guilt. Big, strong, bad can harm, hurt. That's not usually what a caved-in person's feeling. It can be. Some people get caved in about it. But it's more likely, and if they're hallucinating, it's almost always somebody shaming them, unless it's a harmless or a good hallucination. People can see things, hear things. that aren't in the ordinary reality. But anything that gets the attention of psychologists and psychiatrists is going to be bad. Otherwise, people just have these experiences and don't tell anybody that they don't trust, like a doctor. And I can tell a doctor they heard wonderful, soothing voices and it helped them sleep or something like that. Or I heard God telling me that I was going to be okay. I mean, then I can tell anybody like that. But those are really pretty common. But they may tell people something that fits more with the reality. You know what? People will be I haven't thought of this before. People will be less ashamed of saying I'm having a hallucination than, of course, I hear the voice of God or Jesus or nature talking to me. And so, or my dogs. When I sit with my dogs, I hear what they're saying. People will experience that, but to be likely more ashamed of it because it seems more abnormal than hearing psychotic voices. I never thought of this before. That is so interesting. It's one of the reasons why I like doing the impromptu shows. Because they're not very impromptu. I've been doing thinking about these things and lecturing about them. To think that I'm giving an impromptu show is neglecting 40 years of thinking and writing about stuff like this. It's exactly about 45 years that I first started really thinking about guilt, shame, and anxiety. I finally did a book about it only a couple of years ago. So accept how much shame's affecting you. How much you don't maybe want to tell your secrets to your loved one. I'm not saying you should confess things that are going to be destructive to you and a loved one. I mean, there's a place for secrets. Just don't repeat whatever it is you're ashamed. You genuinely think was wrong. Use reason, not shame. Use reason, not shame, to guide yourself. Use love for yourself and for the other person. A lot of what's most beautiful, we have discomforts about. And I remember from earlier in this talk what I was about to tell you about, and then I stopped. When I first had the opportunity in adulthood, instead I told you the story about my childhood, and very alone, and wandering in nature. Well, I've always loved nature. I always loved nature. I much prefer it if I have a loved one with me. I'm still that way, but I love nature, and I can enjoy nature alone. Well, the first time that I had the opportunity as an adult to have a place where I could just go to routinely and be in nature, I would sit down by the water, something I must have done a million times as a kid, and I would feel anxious and uncomfortable. I'd have negative feelings because I wasn't distracting myself with something like writing, which is what I would usually do when I have odd moments of thinking about something. So what I found out, and this may be very useful to you, what I found out is that when I'm alone, just being there on a bench, in bed alone, maybe taking a walk, but that's more active. When you're in a situation where you could meditate and just think and let your feelings flow, you may become especially aware of guilt, shame, and anxiety, or anger in particular, resentments. It's a good time to go and do the inventory. Does this look like shame? Does this look like guilt? Does this look like anxiety? Am I angry a lot? And you may get some hints about what's dominating you. So that's another good way to look at what it is that comes into your mind. And if you read my book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, you'll see there are tests that you can take just to give you an idea of which of your emotions you're experiencing. But learn about them. And then actively, and you can do this while you're sitting alone, experiencing these emotions, that you're guilty about something, ashamed about something, anxious about something, angry, that you want to get numb and have no feelings. You can then pick them apart, look at them. Another analogy I make is it's like gardening. It's like you take out the weeds and you cultivate the flowers. But you have to know to recognize weeds, and you have to know how to cultivate flowers. And some people say loving them helps, talking to them, being there for them, for the plants, the flowers, the trees. I don't know. I don't do it very much. I'd be ashamed. I truly hope that I'm getting across to you more and more my wisdom, my learning, what I've found from all these years. I hope that if this has been a meaningful experience for you, that you will go back and look at my earlier video called Epidemic Anxiety. This one will be called, I decided it just at the beginning, Epidemic Shame, because I realized shame's always epidemic. I think we're less maybe of going into guilt nowadays, but that's there too. Oh God, politicians play on guilt so much. Religious authorities play on guilt so much. Teachers play on guilt so much. That's going to be the next one. It's going to be about guilt. Remember that you can reason, that you can love. Love is joyful. It's a good point to end on as I get to the, near the close. Love is a joyful experience. You know you're loving if you're happy. Relationships can suck. They can get you down. Relationships are relationships. They have guilt, shame, anxiety, anger, and numbing in them. They got a lot of stuff in them. We're human beings. But when you're loving, it's happy and joyful. That's how you identify it. Are you falling in love? Well, are you absolutely happy to be with that person? Oh, I thought it was about sex. No. Love is not about sex. Sex can add to love miraculously. But sex without love, not much. That experience I won't tell you about. Love. Be open to the universe. I believe that there's a God or some other universal presence that teaches us love. Let in the presence of love. Thank you so much for being my audience. This is Peter Bregan. Thank you so, so much. Goodbye now, folks. Goodbye.